Welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel with New Books Network. I'm Sharika Crawford, your host. Today I'm here with Dr. Alexander Fatal. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Communications at the University of California at San Diego. We're here to discuss his latest book, Guerrilla Marketing, Counterinsurgency and Capitalism in Colombia, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2018. Welcome to New Books Network and Latin American Studies, Alex.
Thank you, Sharika. It's wonderful to be here.
I guess we should begin by at least letting our listeners in on the fact that we have known each other for many years now during our time as student grantees in Colombia in the early 2000s. And I was super excited to have the opportunity to do this interview with you just to kind of see the arc of where you began doing research in Colombia to how you have now completed this project with Guerrilla Marketing. I thought it might be interesting for the listeners to get a sense of your background, your professional background, your intellectual background. How did you become interested in media studies, and Colombia in particular?
Yeah, well, I mean, it all comes back to that Fulbright grant. And so for the listeners, Sharika and I, we were part of a cohort of about six U.S. scholars who went to Colombia in 2001, 2002. And that was my first introduction to the country. I had just graduated from my undergraduate studies. I did an interdisciplinary major called Comparative Area Studies. And there I was looking at a lot of Latin American literature. I was taking courses at Duke Center for Documentary Studies, which had a big influence on me in terms of turning me on to photography. But I had only done a semester abroad in Chile. I had not had a lot of experience in Latin America before that year in Bogota. And as I'm sure you remember, that was a kind of significant year to be there. It was the end of a peace process. There was a peace process between 1999 and 2002 known as El Caguan. And so we were there as that was kind of falling apart, and Uribe was getting elected, and it was a kind of tumultuous time in the country. The war was at full boil. And despite the fact that I didn't have a lot of professional experience, I was just a young man who was 22, 23, I could sense the importance of media and propaganda in the conflict. And so I really got interested in that. And I started teaching photography to kids who have the majority of which had been displaced by the armed conflict at about that time. People who had been coming from all different corners of Colombia, which of course is a geographically very diverse country. I mean, you have the Atlantic Ocean, you have the Pacific Ocean, you have three branches of the Andes, the Amazon, the plains going out to Venezuela, a desertic peninsula up in the northeast. So it was a real eye-opening experience for me.
Some of our listeners probably think of Colombia, particularly those who are not specialists in Colombia's culture, politics, or history, are probably familiar mostly with the media interpretation of the drug, you know, war, narco trafficking, particularly with the popularity of the Netflix series on Pablo Escobar, Narcos. But perhaps you could provide a little bit of a summary as to Colombia's other history that has shaped its contemporary reality, that of armed resistance and armed groups battling the Colombian state.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long history, and I feel somewhat daunted speaking to a historian. But, you know, I mean, I think in broad slices, you have a kind of longer history of kind of partisan conflict in Colombia. You know, that goes back to the mid-19th century, questions of liberals and conservatives who would periodically have it out with each other. And then you have the kind of beginning of the Cold War after World War II. And the two, you know, larger historical phenomenon begin to kind of map onto each other in late 1950s and early 1960s. And in 1964, we see the emergence of these two guerrilla groups that are kind of still around today. We can get to that later, but the ELN and the FARC. And so at that point, one of the major frames is the Cold War in Latin America. Of course, the Cuban Revolution happens in 1959. And the civil war in Colombia, you know, grows gradually through the 60s and 70s. You get new entrants to the war. There was a kind of second wave of Latin American guerrilla groups in Colombia that would be represented by the M19. This tended to be guerrilla groups that were more urban. And then, you know, the emergence of drugs in the late 70s and 80s really begins to affect Colombia and the dynamics of the conflict. There's another great book that's out recently, which is called Marijuana Boom by Lina Brito. And she gets into the historical dynamics about the kind of marijuana boom in the northern part of the country that really was a precursor for the kind of cocaine boom that would happen a short decade later. So it's a long history. In the book, I talk about not the Colombian conflict, but rather the Colombian conflicts and how there's this kind of mutating assemblage of conflicts that are constantly kind of remaking one another. There's a kind of shifting cast of actors, armed actors. They tend to be non-state actors that are all vying for power, some of which might be trying to overthrow the government, others might be trying to control a certain territory. So it can get quite kaleidoscopic pretty quickly. But in the beginning of the book, I try to give a kind of synthetic overview of these different conflicts and give a sense of how they kind of bleed, you know, figuratively as well as literally into each other, right? And how the different actors are kind of always studying each other, and why Colombia becomes a laboratory for people who are interested in studying civil wars, because it is so dense, it is so multi-generational.
I noticed that you did quite a bit of reflecting on how you came to this project early on, and part of it you mentioned in your intro when you happened to live at a particularly pivotal moment in the peace process, in ending what is referred to as the civil war in Colombia with the El Caguan talks and the arrival of Uribe as president, Álvaro Uribe, for our listeners who are unfamiliar with his name. And you decided there's been so much done on Colombia in this particular vein that you decided that you wanted to study just one aspect, and that of the Colombian government's efforts to implement a demobilization program, which you explained was handled through the Program for Humanitarian Attention to the Demobilized, or POD, which is ran by the Colombian Ministry of Defense. And one of the things I thought that could be really interesting to get us into your work is for you to discuss a little bit about what this agency was seeking out to do, and how their efforts to kind of create this demobilization program lend itself to what you talk about as brand warfare in Colombia.
Yeah. So this particular program was kind of one pillar of a kind of policy architecture that the Uribe government sets up shortly after kind of taking office in late 2002. And it was a kind of bundle of policies that they called democratic security. It was a kind of curious euphemism. It really was putting security above democratic concerns in many regards. But this particular program was a deserters program. Of course, desertion, defection, these are dynamics that are crucial to any war going back throughout history in any context. But rather than call it this program a deserters program, it referred to it as a demobilization program. And it might seem like splitting hairs, to look at the differences between those terms, but I argue that it's quite significant and kind of broader, part of a broader trend in these policies in the early 2000s that Uribe brings into play. And that really Santos, the next president, Santos, who would take power in 2010, continues in a certain vein. And that is to act as if the war is over while it's still ongoing. You know, at the same time that a lot of the funds that were kind of coursing through the Colombian national security state from Plan Colombia, which was a kind of aid package from Washington, you know, as those funds were kind of working their way through the system and they were kind of getting these Black Hawk helicopters and these different forms of military assistance, and the war effort was really intensifying. At the same time, there were these kind of peacemaking policies that you would expect after the signing of a peace agreement. So it was a very kind of contradictory assemblage of policies. And so they would start what would later become the Center for National Memory. I think at the time it was called the National Center for Reconciliation, CNRR, Center Nacional de Reconciliación y Reparación, Reconciliation and Reparation. So they would, do kind of a truth commission type thing. And they had a negotiation with the National Federation of Paramilitary Groups, and they kind of struck a deal with an ally in a way and tried to bring them into the fold. And there was programs for victims and funding for people who've been affected by the conflict, the types of things that you would imagine. And historically, especially at the end of the Cold War in the late 80s and early 90s, were used to kind of transition from a civil war to a kind of period of national reconciliation. So I really kind of get into this contradiction, right? And ask, why is it that desertion is being framed as demobilization? Because demobilization is what's supposed to happen after you reach a peace agreement, and then the two sides will take their army, reduce the amount of people in their fighting force, and which is, again, what we saw in Central America at the very end of the Cold War. And I came to see that marketing was quite influential in this framing, and it really framing is so central to questions of propaganda and understanding who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. Of course, in any war, there's a rush to kind of reduce the story and kind of control the narrative and frame one side as good guys and one side as bad guys. But certainly for any civilian who's living in a contested territory, they learn quite quickly that these kind of Manichaean dichotomies don't really hold up, that the people who are supposed to be good guys often do bad things and vice versa. And that's not necessarily stable over time. So the individual demobilization struck me as this really curious program. And in 2006, the government approached a high-end marketing firm, the same firm that would manage the brands of Mazda and Red Bull in Colombia, and similar such companies. Mm-hmm. And really asked this company to make this program, the Program for Humanitarian Attention to the Demobilized, essentially an individual desertion program, to make it a brand, right? That this PR firm / marketing agency, their response to the approach was like, we're not going to do a campaign for you, because that was the most common request, that a military or state agency will come in and ask, can you do this campaign for us? And their position was like, no, we're not going to do a campaign for you, because we know you guys in the state. You know, somebody else will get elected, a new general will come into power, and the directives will change, and that won't enable us to have the kind of consistent messaging that we can do over time. And so they said, very well, we'll let you make a brand. And so, you know, when we think about marketing and advertising, we tend to think about the the advertisement as a final product, right? The 30-second commercial, the billboard. These are would have been this kind of iconic outputs of advertising, especially through the 20th century. But really, there's so much that happens on the back end, and the research is really important. And so what the Ministry of Defense did is it opened its doors in terms of the access to the demobilized. And whereas previously, demobilized would be, you know, kept under very strict lock and key in terms of who they could talk to and things like that, they allowed these young marketing researchers to learn about their lives and talk to them about who they are and what their aspirations are, what their motivations are, what they project for themselves into the future, how they understand the armed struggle, and doing research in a somewhat more instrumental way than social scientists in the academy would do. But there was something quasi-sociological or quasi-anthropological in this marketing research. And, you know, the takeaway from that research was you kind of can't use the language of terrorism or the kind of knee-jerk language or discursive formation that was used by the state to refer to the FARC, especially after September 11th. There was a lot of talk in Colombia to refer to the FARC as narco-terrorists, right, and to try to take advantage of this new language to kind of make sure that the FARC was painted as a kind of double devil, which was, you know, the devil of the Cold War for being, you know, Marxist communist, the devil of the drug, the war against a war on drugs, and now also the devil of the war on terror, that it was kind of this perfect enemy, right? But this language of kind of that's used to create an enemy was not the language that was going to be successful in terms of communicating to people who were still in the FARC's ranks. So their approach was, well, we need to speak to them as people. And when you join the FARC, you're asked to forget all the affective ties that you've had as a young person. Oftentimes people are recruited when they're about 15 years old. And so your relationship with your family, you're often told, look, if your family betrays the revolution, you need to be ready to execute your family. There's a kind of psychological preparation that, you know, your new kin are your comrades. And this kind of camaraderie is supposed to replace your previous effective bonds. But of course, that replacement is never entirely successful. And so there was a real kind of strategic decision to try to appeal to people's kind of pre-guerrilla effective life and to say, you know, another life is possible. And that turned out to be the slogan. There is another life. Demobilization is the way out. It rhymes in Spanish. It says, hay otra vida, la desmovilización es la salida. And they would often do things like campaigns to say, before being a guerrilla, you're my son. Here we are, we're speaking to each other the day after Mother's Day. And what they did was they went around and they went to mothers of guerrilla fighters and they scanned the images from their photo albums and put them into posters. And they did a whole campaign around Christmas time, urging people to return home during Christmas and kind of reignite this kind of family bond that they had. And these campaigns took on a very high profile within the government. They won awards at, you know, PR competitions around the globe. And it not only kind of sent a message to the guerrillas who were fighting in the jungles and mountains of Colombia, but it also sent a message to, you know, urban publics in Colombia or to international audiences that the Colombian military was a humanitarian actor. Something that, of course, is quite contested by the human rights community that's always kind of pointing out every time the Colombian government has another human rights scandal. but this was an opportunity to show the kind of benevolence of the institution and the kind of soft side of the army that was willing to kind of pardon even its most bitter enemy. So there was a kind of a lot of work that these campaigns were doing.
And while it may appear as though, you know, what the Colombian government was doing under POD is, I mean, it is, you know, inventive, it's innovative, it's a different way of addressing, as you point out, it's a form of kind of counterinsurgency, which later we'll get into humanitarian counterinsurgency, as oxymoronic as that may sound. You point out later in your work that this was part of what you call a layered history of brand warfare, because essentially Colombia had had earlier manifestations of using marketing as such as a way to engage in, you know, these kind of multiple forms of conflict that we see. And I thought you might want to, you know, share with the listeners a little bit about how other Colombian actors have used propaganda, to kind of wage their war, you know, against the state, if we're talking about armed groups or in other capacities.
Yeah. So, you know, the argument I lay out in chapter one, which is called An Archaeology of Media Spectacle, is that really the state is kind of late to the game in developing this kind of brand warfare that we see in the early 2000s. And it was really a kind of reactive, it assumed a reactive position, a defensive position. And that begins to change at the turn of the millennium with visors coming down from Washington. Really, there's an increasing outsourcing of the propaganda operation. And part of the contracts for Plan Colombia involved this kind of modernization of the army's propaganda apparatus, and that involved a lot of training and things like that. And part of those trainings were, look, you need to treat the information space as any other space in the war, and you need to be aggressive, and you need to kind of fight for the high ground, and using all these kind of military metaphors to try to change the communicational culture within the armed forces. But my argument is that this is happening largely because, you know, for a few decades now, the Colombian government has not been offensive. So I go back to the launch of the M19, a guerrilla group I mentioned earlier, where they kind of have a big coming out event by stealing Simón Bolívar's sword. Of course, Simón Bolívar is the independence hero of Northern South America. He is a legendary figure. He's kind of would be akin to the George Washington in the United States. He had many swords, but one of the swords that was in Colombia was at a museum that was actually at the foot of Los Andes University, where many of the Fulbright scholars studied. And it was one of his homes. It's called La Quinta de Bolívar. And these guerrillas came in as it was closing one night, stole the sword and left a communique, and directed the press to read the communique, which was this kind of poetically worded document that says, you know, Simón Bolívar's sword breaks through the cobwebs of the museum and now points its tip at foreigners and elites, and, you know, a whole revolutionary discourse. And they had what they would describe as armed propaganda, which was essentially, privileging the political message over the military impact. So they had a series of kind of very high profile events, some of which went well for them, others not so well. The last major one was their attempt, their overtaking of the Supreme Court in Colombia, which ended very badly, of course, with the Colombian government sending in tanks. But they were seeing that as a propaganda effort to hold the government at the time accountable for promises it had made during a peace accord that was signed in 1984. So, you know, the M19 was quite media savvy, and I think it led a lot of the other armed actors to pay attention, not least of which were the likes of Pablo Escobar. So when Pablo Escobar is facing extradition to the United States, he kind of bands together with a bunch of his associates and he creates a group called the Extraditables. And he treats this group, the Extraditables, as a brand. And he kind of pairs it with this very spectacular violence that he would level against institutions and journalists and make sure that he, and not only through this horrific violence, but also through kind of very concerted and strategic messaging, manages to really guide public debate around the question of extradition and how that was playing into a constitutional assembly in the early 1990s. And then, you know, I go on to say, well, whereas the FARC tried to absorb some of these lessons and it took up the language of Bolivar, like the M19 had, and it kidnapped high-profile people like Escobar had, they didn't have the same kind of media savvy, and their focus on kidnapping really ended up backfiring and hurting them politically, as it was, you know, rightfully portrayed as a very inhumane and regressive tactic. And, you know, whereas they were hoping to be seen as these kind of Robin Hoods who were kind of holding the rich captive to raise funds for their popular revolution, it was really never framed that way at all, and ended up costing them, you know, a lot of political capital. So that's the kind of general trajectory of that first chapter. But I think it's over the course of those years, from the mid-70s to about 2000, that the government kind of gets wise to the fact that it needs to move the propaganda effort to the kind of center of the counterinsurgency strategy.
And as you pointed out earlier, I mean, you know, part of their strategy, right, is to create these marketing campaigns that attempt to expand or capitalize on maybe we might want to say a weakness of these armed groups, perhaps like the FARC or the ELN, the ways in which they eroded or attempted to erode kind of family attachment, and thus these campaigns are very emotive. And I thought that you might want to talk maybe to the listeners about one of these very successful marketing campaigns by the POD during the Christmases of 2010 or 2011, in which some of their awards kind of rightly point to, and their success in terms of media, spectacular, you know, displays of trying to reach the so-called demobilized.
Yeah, the Christmas campaign was, it garnered the most attention, that's for sure. So it started in 2010, where they lit up a Christmas tree in the middle of the jungle. And it said, the slogan was, "Gorilla, if we could bring Christmas to the jungle, you can celebrate it at home." And again, trying to tap into this kind of weakness for, you know, missing home life and missing those effective bonds. And that really generated all sorts of publicity on the national and international press. And the commercials were well produced. And you had these young marketing fellows running around with the special forces of Colombia into the Macarena, this kind of FARC territory. And so it had all the pieces of a kind of spectacular success. So you had CNN and Wired magazine and all sorts of outlets saying, you know, Colombian government's new weapon against the FARC, Christmas trees. So it's hard to say how many people it actually motivated to leave. The publicists, of course, in their, you know, they're doing their own branding as well. These campaigns, as Sergio Jaramillo, the strategist of this POD program, really, as he predicted when he approached the firm, which is known as Low SSP3, he says, "Look, we can't pay you as much as your corporate clients, such as Mazda, but you know, you're going to win all of the awards." And he was kind of quite prescient about that. So you know, the the publicist managed to get a lot more business. And, you know, later the UN approached them and all sorts of people approached them. And the exposure probably helped bring the program to the attention of more active guerrilla fighters. But when compared to some of the other programs and the intelligence units who would be monitoring these different fronts of the FARC, it really felt a different campaign was even more effective, which was a campaign that was structured around soccer. It was called Come Back and Play, or Vuelve a Jugar, in which the Colombian government would do kind of quirky things like put stickers on soccer balls and throw them out of the windows of helicopters. And it was a whole campaign structured around the sense of, you know, if you leave, you can be free to play soccer with your friends and kind of have this kind of social connection with people who are not only in the FARC, but you can have this kind of this freedom that you might have felt when you were a kid playing soccer. So then you can kind of relive that childhood experience. And that was a campaign that different intelligence battalions around the country would start to take up on their own and would end up copying the commercial. So the commercial ends up kind of affecting real life, which is something we didn't see in the Christmas campaigns, right? I think there was a kind of division between the kind of imaginary world of public relations and the real world. So there were about five Christmas campaigns from 2010 to 2014, all around, you know, the subject of Christmas and whatnot. So in 2011, that was the campaign that I witnessed, and the president would put little glowing balls in the river, supposedly with messages to different FARC people who might be downriver. And for me, you know, that was perhaps less effective than the Christmas tree in the middle of the jungle. The 2013 campaign was the one that I mentioned of, Before Being a Guerrilla, You Are My Child. They had another one called the Star of Bethlehem, where anti-aircraft lights were used as ostensible guides to lead guerrillas out of the rural areas and be able to turn themselves into the cities. So, you know, they were quite imaginative, and the Christmas campaigns were very successful in kind of generating buzz. But as I get in chapter three, which is where I'm embedded in an intelligence battalion, you see that there is a drive to immobilize very particular guerrilla fighters, you know, high value targets, people who would be leading these different fronts. That this was really done not by kind of mass publicity operations, but rather through individualized appeals to people who were close to these guerrilla fighters, in which they would kind of psychologically profile and track their loved ones and try to kind of make an appeal through a sister or a former lover or something like that. And so my sense is that those kind of more micro-targeted campaigns, if you will, to use the same language as marketing, and I think it's certainly interesting, something I point out in the introduction, that kind of marketing and militarism often share a kind of language such as targeting, right? I started out this research by really focusing on the glitz and the glamour of these marketing campaigns, but then was intrigued by everything that was happening with the military intelligence side of it, and how this kind of highly classified and highly publicized parts of the program were kind of two sides of the same coin. And that's why I've juxtaposed these two chapters, one about Operation Christmas, in which I'm doing a kind of embedded ethnography in the production of the 2011 Christmas campaign. And chapter four, which is called Operation Genuine, which was an operation that the military used to demobilize this commander. It was really an interesting operation because he was the military intelligence unit was trying to get him and hopefully his entire group of about 15 rebels that were in Colombia. They had crossed the border from their base in Venezuela. And this guy was traveling with 15 guerrillas, and the intelligence unit wanted to get them to demobilize, but the commanding general ultimately decided to bomb, and the guy survived, and at that point turned himself in. So, you know, one of the lines that the military liked to repeat was that demobilized were even more valuable than killing somebody in combat, because you leave a huge question mark. When I interviewed the national security advisor for the Santos administration, is essentially what he said. He says, look, if you kill somebody, you make people angry. But if you demobilize somebody, you leave a huge question mark. And you say, well, you know, where did they go? Why are they there? Why are they there? And why am I here? And so despite that, there was a kind of ingrained military culture that still kills were more important than demobilization. So it was interesting to see, you know, all of these things as they kind of came into contact with each other, as demobilization was increasingly moving to the center of the counterinsurgency operation, you know, providing critical human intelligence that could corroborate technical intelligence, that could do all sorts of things to help debilitate the FARC. But at the same time, there was this kind of harder kernel of just a kind of ingrained military culture.
I think it bears some discussion about how you, as an anthropologist — our listeners may not be aware, you're an anthropologist — how were you able to gain the access to the people that you would need to gain access to do this ethnography? You're talking about high-level officials in the military, civilian individuals in the military, marketing, you know, high-end luxury marketing brands. You're traveling, you know, to peace talk sites in Cuba. You're having to track down former guerrillas. Maybe they're in Sweden or other parts of Europe. Could you talk a little bit about how you came to gain access to what many might assumed would have been really difficult, and also the challenges that you faced as they try to figure out, you know, what you really were there for? Were you there for academic, you know, research, or did you have some other nefarious reason for tracing and tracking them?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I asked myself that same question, but I I guess the best answer is time, right? I mean, I had the luxury of being a PhD student and funding to kind of keep coming back for many summers in a row, and then 2 years straight. And then even after getting the PhD, I would spend, you know, 6 months at a time in Colombia. And so, you know, different people I came into contact with at different times. So during the main research, I really didn't have any contact with active guerrillas. That would have been a little bit too dicey. It was really only once the peace agreement was well advanced, the peace negotiations were well advanced, that I traveled to Cuba and traveled to Southern Colombia and met with a series of active guerrillas. But going back to the Fulbright days in 2001, you might remember a friend and colleague of ours, Abby Steele, who's a political scientist.
Absolutely.
She introduced me to somebody at the U.S. Embassy who misunderstood, you know, desplazado for desmovilizado. She does her research on displaced people. I was, you know, trying to do research on the demobilization programs that were starting up. And so she was mistakenly referred to this guy, and then she passed me his card, and I followed up with him. And then he made a key introduction to a woman by the name of Marcella, who features in the book, who was really quite instrumental in putting this pod program together. So I got a series of opportune introductions and just kind of followed those to ground and kind of kept going back. And you know, different people would pass me off to different people, and I would keep kind of moving around in this labyrinth. And then suddenly I'd find myself in a cul-de-sac, and I'd like shoot down and go someplace else. But yeah, it is certainly, I think if I look at the, from the, you know, I imagine how the pod viewed me. You know, I think they viewed me through the same lens that they view a lot of journalists that they come into contact as, you know, another opportunity to kind of generate some good PR for the program. I do think, you know, they feel that they're doing something that's very good and very important. In a way, they're not wrong in that they're getting people out of the war. You know, clearly I was doing something that was going to be more elaborate, more complex, and, you know, honestly, more critical than most journalists would do. And so I think, you know, they kind of see this and they realize this and they start looking into me and they're concerned I'm not who I say I am. And people say, well, you've spoken to too many people. So the relationships ebbed and flowed over time. Ultimately time was, you know, my best ally. And, you know, I felt like, you know, I was honest in the way that I framed the project. And I think people came to see that and appreciate that. And my hope is the Read the Book, which has been translated into Spanish and published by the Editorial del Rosario, La Merced del Rosario. I feel that, you know, this is perhaps a critical but honest and truthful account of the program.
No, I mean, yeah, it was wonderful that you've been able to interweave. But I was struck by, you know, the reality of the circumstances of Colombia, and that what you were, you know, investigating is something that's very sensitive. It's multiple actors. You know, it's one that requires a level of sensitivity, dedication, but also a healthy fear if necessary, just because of the nature of the topic. And it's been wonderful to see you handle that component as well in the book. You do address that, and I thought that was worth discussing. I wanted to get to a part of your book that we haven't really touched on fully, and that's the capitalist. I mean, part of it's the marketing, which is capitalist oriented, but even some of the nature of the involvement or the evolving nature of the marketing scheme, of how they're presenting a sense of peace, how they're presenting freedom to these demobilized actors. Could you talk a little bit about the ways in which the marketing campaign sought to kind of make freedom and peace kind of a consumer product?
Sure. This is fascinating, and there's a kind of long history to this. If we look at the U.S. and I hope we'll spend a little time to talk about the kind of interesting relationship that this program and Colombia in general plays for kind of U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine and policymaking around war and peace. But, you know, we could go back to World War One and the Committee for Public Information in the U.S. and, you know, really the beginnings of Madison Avenue in New York, with a lot of people who, once the war effort was over, were also involved in branding the kind of post-World War One piece. There is a shift when the peace negotiations are in an advanced stage. In, you know, peace negotiations in Colombia, the Havana negotiations at least start in 2012 and they run to late 2016. And so, you know, after the Uribe years of 2002 to 2010, where the narrative was very successfully generated that, you know, the cure for all of Colombia's ills, including, you know, devastating inequality, inequality of land distribution, poverty, you know, lack of development in the rural areas, you know, all of those things were kind of bracketed out and to say, look, the root cause of all of our problems is the existence of the FARC. So the FARC was turned into public enemies 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, upward to however you want to count. And, you know, suddenly the Santos administration had to kind of begin to flip that script and present peace as an opportunity for development. I think one of its slogans was prosperity for all. And so there was a sense that peace needed to be presented as something that was possible in a country that was, you know, so ravaged by this conflict for so many generations, and, you know, be familiar. I think there's a kind of certain familiarity to the kind of marketing messages. So, you know, we could see a magazine like Soho, which would be a kind of an equivalent to Playboy, running a front page article and spread in which a gorilla, a female gorilla, and a female detective that was in charge of hunting gorillas pose naked and are interviewed by the ideological opposite journalist. And there's this whole kind of performative thing in which peace is not really discussed as in terms of addressing the structural challenges that, you know, were addressed in this 310-page peace accord that was signed in 2016, but were kind of left out of the popular discussion. So I think, you know, looking back on the Havana negotiations, I think there was just a kind of disjuncture between the discussions that were happening at the negotiating table and the kind of broader public conversation. And I think everybody kind of realized that towards the end of the negotiations, but it was a kind of a little bit too late to kind of reverse course.
Towards the end of your book, you have this discussion of how the Colombian government in the success, at least their marketing success, if you will, and then obviously by 2016, the kind of success of, you know, the official ending of the conflict, they are presenting themselves as a model for kind of a post-conflict nation. You mentioned that it's a country that people often, you know, return to understand these types of evolving civil wars. Perhaps you might kind of end a little bit of the discussion about your book, in particular surrounding kind of what model could Colombia offer to the United States, for example, its longtime ally and partner, or to other countries with kind of long-stem civil wars?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my first comment would be to be a bit cautious about using Colombia, or really almost any country, as a template for any other country. I mean, I know this is common, and this might be the anthropologist in me talking, has a somewhat allergic reaction to kind of to comparative framework. But, you know, I do think each country presents its own kind of specificities. And if we look at what's happening in Colombia right now, unfortunately, it's an extremely violent moment. We have FARC dissident groups. We have narco paramilitary groups. We have the ELN that has kind of gained some ground. And, you know, as most analysts predicted, you know, all sorts of armed groups would come in and fill the vacuum that the FARC would leave. I think ideally the government would come in not only with the military presence, but also with other state institutions and kind of fill that vacuum. But that's not, you know, it's beyond what is pragmatic in the country. So we've seen all sorts of other groups come in, many of which have ties to the drug trafficking. And as they vie for territory, it's been a very violent moment. We've seen a lot of social leaders killed. We've seen a lot of former FARC guerrillas killed. So, you know, in the conclusion of the book, I follow around this delegation, an international delegation from people from Iraq, Afghanistan. I mean, there was the number two in the High Peace Council in Afghanistan, who was a former Taliban spokesperson, both in Pakistan and the United Nations, who was on this tour. There was people who were doing, heading reintegration programs in Western Iraq on this tour. There were people from Western Africa who were on this tour. There were people from Nepal. There were people from Somalia. I mean, it was a real cosmopolitan group who were kind of getting the pony show. But, you know, it was very, like these marketing campaigns themselves, it was a very rosy depiction of what was happening on the ground and how fraught the reintegration process was. So in chapter four, I get into, you know, the real difficulties of economically reintegrating these former guerrillas and the kind of temptation that remobilizing with a, you know, either a different guerrilla group or a paramilitary structure poses. And so, you know, this sense of combatants being recycled and the war continuing is unfortunately what we're seeing right now. So I'm not sure Colombia presents the best model. But I do think there are lessons to be learned. And I think, you know, one of the lessons to be learned is from Colombia's own history. If we go back to the 1950s, after, you know, the partisan violence of the late 40s and early 50s was spiraling out of control. And Rojas Pinilla, kind of general from the military, was put in charge for about 4 years. He issued a series of amnesties, and he had all these ambitious plans to rehabilitate the country and develop the countryside, but they weren't feasible. And so I think, you know, with the Havana negotiations, the Colombian government would have done well to have a more reasonable negotiation that people could get behind in a way that would be more credible. So, you know, I think I'm a major fan of the Havana Accord. I think it has done important work in getting a historical actor to put down their guns. But I'm really concerned about the future of the country. So I'm skeptical of this sense that, you know, Colombia, the brand warfare that the Colombian military was doing, was really kind of nestled into a broader effort that Colombia was doing throughout the 2000s and 2010s, and even today, to kind of market the country as a place that was ready for tourists, as ready for foreign investment. I think you remember from our time in 2001, we were as gringos, we were, you know, were relatively few of us. I think Colombia is awaiting like 7 million or something foreign tourists last year. So this re-narration of the nation, it's important, but it's important that it reflects reality as well.
I'm curious to hear if you have any small or large ongoing projects, whether they be continuations of your work here in guerrilla marketing or new topics elsewhere.
Sure. Well, you know, I've been working on three long-term projects, and they have all kind of come to fruition as of late. One is guerrilla marketing. The other is a film called Limbo, which is a portrait of a guerrilla fighter that was recorded entirely in the back of a truck that I transformed into a giant camera obscura. So kind of fairly experimental methodology there. But I think it gives a good sense of what many former guerrillas experience in terms of kind of being haunted by their past and kind of being stuck in the state that's kind of not quite military and not quite civilian. And I think it's all too germane for the current post peace accord moment. And another book, which is Shooting Cameras for Peace, and that's a bilingual book, Shooting Cameras for Peace, Esperando Cameras para la Paz, which is kind of the greatest hits from a 10,000 image archive that came out of this program that I started way back in 2001 called Shooting Cameras for Peace, that would go on to be a Colombian nonprofit organization and lasted as such for about 10 years. And so I kind of celebrate students' photography and at the same time give a kind of critical analysis of the process and how the process itself was somewhat fraught, and trying to negotiate different people's perspectives and different stakeholders' perspectives in this kind of participatory photography project. So that'll be out with Harvard University Press in about a month. So it's got a landing page, which I can direct your listeners to. And in terms of future projects, I'm really interested in the really wonderful photojournalistic work that's being done in the country. When the Havana negotiations started, I think we saw a real rush to publish a lot of work that had been ongoing for a long time. There was a kind of sense of an opening. And so I have this project that's called Transitional Visions, in which I'm researching a lot of the photography and photographic collectives that are going on. It's a kind of really rich set of representations that kind of get into the complicated realities of the conflict in a creative way. So that's one project. And, you know, now I'm living in the San Diego Tijuana border area. And I've also helped to start a nonprofit here a long time ago. And so they're doing really interesting work in with the transfronterizo community in terms of people who are, you know, maybe work on one side of the border, but live on the other and have kind of their lives straddle the border, and to kind of give an alternative representation through their own photographic projects and reflections on how they see this border, which tends to be portrayed in popular culture as this, you know, extremely militarized space, to kind of give it a more human dimension. So there's a few of the projects that I've got lined up, but we'll see what else kind of comes up along the way.
I look forward to reading your new work and also viewing your film, your documentary film, Limbo, correct?
Yeah. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking with you again, Alex. Thank you for joining New Books Network in Latin American Studies.
Thank you so much, Sharika.
You can find a link to Dr. Fatal's latest book, Guerrilla Marketing, Counterinsurgency, and Capitalism in Colombia, published by the University of Chicago Press, on New Books Network in Latin American Studies. Until next time.